the philosopher Nietzsche said, without music, life would be a mistake.
And as somebody said, without Bach, God would be a very boring fellow.
Touché. Okay, let's turn to music and the Eternal Song. One of the things that in my own reading and study has come to be very much part of my awareness is that there is a kind of a primal element to music, that there are aspects of what we have evolved into music that are, that even in utero, a fetus will recognize the rhythm of the mother's breathing or heartbeat, yeah, which can then be, you know, later in life, form the basis of other kinds of rhythm. Changes in pitch because the unborn will hear the rising and falling of tones in the mother's voice or in, yeah, whatever sounds penetrate. And the sense of a kind of empathic awareness of emotion associated with the different character of voice or sounds that may reach. And I don't know to what extent we have research to understand the effects of sound.
Oh, we have.
Before birth, yeah.
We have.
Those things strike me as being an almost innate predisposition towards what later becomes perceived as music. And that also leads me to, and particularly that sensitivity to the emotional elements that will be in, you know, I don't know whether it's right to say implanted or imprinted or just registered in some way from the time of birth. Certainly a child from the moment they're born knows how to express their negative emotions. They cry and make, you know, often a remarkably huge volume of sound for their size and vocal apparatus. But the first actual music I think most of us experience is our mothers singing to us, and yeah, often the sweetest songs of our lives. I don't think any of us, whether our mothers had, you know, trained voices, you know, experienced singing or not, didn't find that to be the most pleasurable, the most beautiful sounding, and the most comforting music that we have experienced from the beginning to the end of life.
I think you're absolutely right. First of all, if you look at indigenous music from the north, Greenland, or Alaska, to down to the states of Wendofuka, you know, anywhere in Africa, everywhere, the drumming, the rhythm, it's absolutely universal. It does begin, I believe, with what you just said about the mother's biorhythms, including their heartbeat, which the baby hears.
Mm-hmm.
And also universal are lullabies. And the lullabies are sung in a different register than ordinary. And they're intuitive. Like even that song, Rock-a-bye Baby, the words may be rather intimidating, but the tone is soothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's sweet.
Yes.
There's a psychologist friend of mine and a co-author of one of my books, Hold On To Your Kids, Gordon Neufeld, who studied lullabies. The prosody, the tone of voice, and its impact on the infant, and its impact on the nervous system, its capacity to soothe or to agitate. I think probably lullabies were the first songs. And drum beat was the first musical expression.
Yep, absolutely. Just if I can reference something from the world of Western classical music, of course, one, yeah, of the best known of all lullabies is the so-called Brahms lullaby.
Yeah.
But in fact, he produced an enormous body of piano music. And for me, to my taste, of that enormous, immense literature, there is one piece that stands out as the most sublime and beautiful, and it is the first intermezzo of his Opus 117, which is in fact a lullaby. It's immediately recognizable as a lullaby, even though it has no words. And it is simply a transporting experience in its serenity and in its soothing quality. So anyway, if anyone has a chance, write down Opus 117, Brahms number 1, and check it out because it is a magnificent piece.
Is it a part of a piano sonata or what is it?
It is actually a collection of short pieces, Opus 117 Intermezzi.
But I have to tell you, when you mentioned lullabies, I had a certain frisson of sadness here because I don't remember ever having been sung to.
Oh.
I don't think I had lullabies sung to me. At least I have no recollection of it. I don't know, but it's brought up some sadness now, you know.
I'm so sorry, but I'll bet you had them, even if you don't recall them.
Possibly I did, you know, but also under the times, the Nazi occupation, my mother's terror, I don't know how much mood she was in to sing lullabies.
Right.
Anyway, all I'm telling is that was my emotional reaction when you brought that up.
I'm sorry to have raised something that...
It's good for me to notice.
If I can resort to a literary reference, and this, I'm going to read something. I hope you'll have the patience because it's a little long, but the idea of the primacy of music or the primal quality has always made me think of something that is a literary work that contrasts with something in the New Testament. In the book of John, you find the famous line, "In the beginning was the Word."
Yeah.
But in the posthumous book by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is, of course, a fantasy book, The Silmarillion, his opening presents an alternate creation story. And I feel so deeply drawn to this that I thought I'd share it with you if you don't mind.
Please.
So it's the opening chapter is called The Music of the Aenir. And the Aenir are the archangels. In this case, Eru, or alternately named Ilúvatar, is the supreme being, the god figure. So there was Eru, the one who in Arda is called Ilúvatar, and he made first the Aenir, the holy ones, that were the offspring of his thought, and they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music, and they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long while they sang only each alone, but few together, while the rest hearkened, for each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came. And in the understanding of their brethren, they grew but slowly, yet ever as they listened, they came to deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony. And it came to pass that Ilúvatar called together all the Aenir and declared to them a mighty theme, unfolding to them things greater and more wonderful than he had yet revealed. And the glory of its beginning and the splendor of its end amazed the Aenir, so that they bowed before Ilúvatar and were silent. Then Ilúvatar said to them, "Of the theme I have declared to you, I will now that ye make in harmony together a great music. And since I have kindled you with the flame imperishable, ye shall show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his own thoughts and devices, if he will. But I will sit and hearken, and be glad that through you great beauty has been wakened into song." Then the voice of the Aenir, like unto harps and lutes and pipes and trumpets and viols and organs, and unto countless choirs singing with words, began to fashion the theme of Ilúvatar to a great music, and a sound arose of endless interchanging melodies, woven in harmony, that passed beyond hearing into the depths and into the heights, and the places of the dwelling of Ilúvatar were filled to overflowing, and the music and echo of the music went out into the void, and it was not void. Never since have the Aenir made any music like to this music, though it has been said that a greater still shall be made before Ilúvatar by choirs of the Aenir and the children of Ilúvatar after the end of days. So there's a creation myth based on
music. Yeah.
And I've always found that both powerful, compelling, and of course, having spent my life in and around music, it's extremely appealing. But I think the idea of conceiving of something at the beginning of time that draws upon music, and perhaps the concept of Pythagoras about music being part of the, you know, the unalterable nature of the universe, the same as the mathematical relations, is something that really reflects the kind of innateness in human experience of music?
Sure. So first of all, harmony is not strictly or simply or exclusively a musical expression.
Right.
In fact, nature is in harmony. And it's like Beethoven's Sixth, you know, like you got these storms and so on, but in the end, you know, there's a harmony, you know, and it has to be. It's just, that's the nature of nature, is harmony. It's in harmony with itself. Number one. Number two, there's all kinds of song before there's human song. There's bird song. And human beings hear this, you know. Number three, there's no more beautiful experience for human beings than to be in harmony with another or with others, you know. So that what I'm saying is that there's song even before there's song.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If we can turn to what we have been learning over the past several decades about the brain neuroplasticity, and I'm not an expert, but I have had a great deal of interest and I've done some reading. And one of the things that I know that science has discovered in terms of early childhood development, which goes hand in hand with the period in which we may be the most susceptible to trauma, is that there is something called the first critical period of neurological development, which usually is mapped between birth and 5 years of age, in which an enormous number of synapses form, connections are made, consciousness and cognition grows, socialization is formed, and many of the other things that basically form the basis of the underpinning of our reality for the rest of our lives. And one of the things that we are learning about music is that it has the unique aspect of engaging all or virtually all of the areas of the brain simultaneously. So it generates pleasure, dopamine, from the nucleus accumbens. It involves speech recognition and processing, Broca's area and Wernicke's area. It engages the emotions, the amygdala. It produces pattern recognition, the frontal lobe. It facilitates physical coordination, dance and rhythmic movement, which I believe is the cerebellum. The occipital lobe, visualization, which sometimes manifests as synesthesia, memory, the hippocampus, imitation and repetition, the mirror neurons, processing and integration of all these centers together to create a recognizable whole, the corpus callosum, as well as the fact that music has been shown to stimulate, if it's soothing and pleasant music, the hormone for bonding and love, oxytocin, and also to reduce the stress stress hormone. So with all of those elements together, and there may be other forms of expression that have many areas of the brain engaged simultaneously, but because of the features of music, it really seems to be an exceptionally psychoactive element in our development. And I'm wondering whether you have any thoughts on that, and particularly how those stimuli can impact early childhood development, if there's a lot of music in a child's life, potentially how it can affect them as children grow to maturity, particularly with respect to things like emotional resiliency.
Well, first of all, you've articulated it, the neurological impacts and mechanisms of music more articulated than I could have. In terms of regulation, first of all, let's just notice that music has an immediate effect on the nervous system. All kinds of music does. And it can agitate and also soothe. If you look at, in Quebec, some school boards during the COVID crisis, and they had to limit certain classes, and the first thing they dropped was drama and music. And if you actually look at all the play, if you actually look at what promotes brain development, it's not cognitive learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's precisely those participatory experiences of music, singing, play, and drama, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first point. In terms of regulation, there's a friend of mine, Stephen Porges, who's a psychologist, and he deals with, the nervous system and the autonomic nervous system, including how the autonomic nervous system regulates the heart and breathing and the intestines and so on. And he's very interested in autistic kids. And what he does is he plays music to them to help them develop presence and self-regulation. I can't begin to go into the theory of what exactly he does, but that is what he does. He's developed a musical way of how certain sounds, musical sounds, will affect the nervous system of the child,
mm-hmm.
Open them up more. So it's hugely important. I don't know if you studied algebra in school. I did.
A little. Not that I've retained much.
Well, I retained nothing. Although at the time, I could solve all these problems. I had to. But if you ask people to mention the relative importance of algebra in their lives compared to the relative importance of music,
mm-hmm.
what would most people tell you? There's not even any comparison.
Not at all.
Like music is just so essential to people's experience of life.
Right.
Which is, of course, this big business, and it's exploited in all kinds of ways, but they're exploiting something very real.
Yes.
Which is the essential human need for music. That has to do with our nervous systems.
It's, incidentally, as you know, I was in the music business, and we used to have a saying, the only good thing about the music business is the music. So I'd like to actually take a moment, because it picks up on some of the themes, and share with you some photographs. And these are all representations of a music program that originated in South America. I may have mentioned it to you when we first spoke, called El Sistema.
Venezuela.
The Venezuelan system.
What's his name? Gustavo Dudamel being his
Gustavo,
name.
Yes, Gustavo Dudamel, and its founder, Jose Antonio Abreu, who was both a musician and an economist. And I've been down there on a number of occasions. And so these are not professional photographs, but I think they illustrate some interesting points that pick up on issues that we've touched on so far. So, okay, this is something that you'll see if you visit Caracas and many other cities in South America. You'll see that these are hillside favelas that are extremely unattractive, and in which there is a great deal of crime, drug use, criminality, violence. So that's a perfect breeding ground for trauma. Within that environment, you will find this. So these are El Sistema, what they call nucleos, after-school programs, where there is a great deal of play that accompanies the giving of music lessons. The program starts in early childhood, often engaging the parents, even though they live a very hard life and they have trouble finding the time. Play, clapping exercises, learning to hum. That progresses to classrooms in which there is a great deal of informality and fun. And the teachers are often on the ground at an eye level or close to as they can get with the kids. And that leads to years and years of ensemble performance. The main focus is playing together in a group without competitiveness about who's better or worse. In fact, the better students are often sitting side by side with the weaker ones so that they can help them. So we see that evolves into mature students in the program who form large orchestral ensembles who play together and achieve a very high level of success. So they get a great deal of of reinforcement by how strong their playing becomes, how effective they become as orchestra members. And the thing that I notice among them is an enormous degree of focus and concentration. So that's, I think, a kind of illustration, not to say that one program is the be-all and end-all, but some of the what I would call the principles that can be embodied in the evolution of music programs that can have a positive effect on the lives of children from early childhood on into adolescence.
Do you know, have you ever heard about the Landfill Harmonic?
I have, yes, and in fact they are going to be with us during this World Congress.
Fantastic. Well, there's another really dramatic example of kids living in the slums of the slums next to a garbage dump. And they fashion instruments out of discarded metal and plastic and wood. And these kids learn classical music. And what a difference it makes to their lives. You know, Brian, it feels a bit like we were presenting here a commercial for oxygen, you know, like we have to convince the world, you know, oxygen is really important. By the way the world is going, we might have to start selling commercials for oxygen. But the fact that one would have to sell the importance of oxygen, like clean air, what does it say about the state of the world that we have to convince of it, of the need for clean air? Well, what does it say about the state of the world that we strive to educate people on the importance of music?
Right.
You know, both of them represent a real disconnection. Because anybody who's connected knows how important music is, you know, to the child, to the infant, to the infant-parent bond.
Right, right.
To one's emotional development, to one's social engagement. It's such a social activity, like in the sistema. It's not an individual activity. It's a social activity.
Mm-hmm.
And all the large numbers of people, whatever you can say about the quality of the music that sometimes people gather to take in, depends on your tastes. But if you look at the large numbers of people that just gather to experience music together, you know, it's like oxygen for the human soul.
It absolutely is. And I dare say that in our highly commercialized society, we tend to assign the value of things according to how much money they can be turned into.
Yeah.
This value, this oxygenic value, would exist regardless of whether you could make $1 million, become a big star or a celebrity, whether you could, you know, create an entire industry based on overpricing tickets and all the rest. It is something that, you know, again, to go back to that Thatcher quote, it is the opposite of her statement. There is such a thing as society. Music is an expression of it, particularly when made in this way. Dr. Abreu, the founder of El Sistema, said, an orchestra is the only organization whose sole purpose is to be in harmony with itself. Mm. And that is, I think, a very profound thought when you start looking at the creation of social bonds and the ability for people to engage with each other in productive, healthy, and psychically reinforcing rather than diminishing ways. But I don't mean to go on at such great length, and you're right, we don't need to sell it, except that we do, because all across the world today, there are generations of children who can't study music. Even in our own schools in this wealthy, developed country, it is seen as an easy-to-cut extra from curricula. And so it seems to me that sadly, we do have to advertise oxygen in this case. And it really strikes me that we've been talking about music in the absence of trauma, just as a child growing up, as young people forming their bonds and maturing. But let's talk about music in the presence of trauma. And that we're talking about, like so many young people in whose lives there is some element of emotional wound and pain. and to think about whether music can help. And again, I tend to reach far back into history, but, you know, I would start perhaps with the Aristotelian concept of catharsis. Is there a cathartic effect in music that can, to some extent, and I'm not talking about cures, because healing is a process, not a pill, but really that can be an element in the road to healing?
Well, first of all, Margaret Thatcher, by the way, a very traumatized person. And her statement that there's no society reflected her own isolation and emotional isolation. She ended her life in complete isolation in the coils of dementia, which is not. As interestingly enough, did her ideological partner, Ronald Reagan. And they're both very traumatized people.
That statement reminds me of actually a Slavic folk tale about the peasant who is living on the verge of starvation and has only one thing to his name to sustain him, and that's his cow. And one morning he wakes up and looks in the field, and the cow is on its side dead. And he realizes that he's now facing starvation, and he doesn't even have the day's milk or to make into butter or cheese, and that he's going to go hungry. So he goes down to the river to fish, and he feels a tug on his line, and out of the water comes a golden fish, clearly magical, and the fish speaks to him and says, "Farmer, free me, and I will give you your wish." And the farmer says, "Well, let's see. I have nothing. I'm on the verge of starvation. Well, I just lost the one thing that I have to my name, my cow. My cow died today. Let me think. Fish, make my neighbor's cow die." So people who are traumatized that way seem to want to spread the good or rather ill news as widely as they can so that they're not suffering alone, I think.
Well, that's true. And there's many ramifications of that, including in people who abuse kids. But to come back to your question about catharsis, catharsis is not by itself healing. You can have catharsis, but unless it's followed by some new meaning that you can arrive at, the catharsis itself becomes almost like an orgasmic experience that you want it again and again, but it doesn't transform you. So, Hitler was a great music fan. Of course, he loved Wagner, although he didn't get Wagner at all. I mean, if you look at the Ring cycle, what's the essence of it? That the striving for wealth and power is destructive.
Yes.
That's the essence of it. You know, the gods end up being annihilated, you know.
Right, and destroying the world around them.
So, I mean, Hitler learned nothing at all. You know, maybe Wagner himself didn't learn his own lesson, I don't know, but it's certainly in there. A lot of catharsis in that music. A lot of catharsis. And Beethoven's Ninth. That last movement is like a giant emotional orgasm. And as I mentioned to this photograph that I saw, I'm pretty sure it was 1944 or 43, Vienna, the Vienna Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Carl Böhm in Beethoven's Ninth. And there's a photograph of the orchestra and the audience. The audience is glittering with the military medals of the Wehrmacht and the SS. And the choir is singing Alles Menschen werden Brüder, all men will be brothers, and these people go out there and they commit mass murder. You can have emotional catharsis without any healing. Mm-hmm. So that's catharsis by itself. And there were psychotherapeutic approaches that focused on catharsis, mm-hmm. but they did not transform people.
Can catharsis then, if coupled with other elements of healing, treatment, self-discovery, and also identification of the sources of pain, become an element if used in a strategically effective way.
Yeah, and when I work with people, I don't look for catharsis. I look for whatever arises. Mm-hmm. If it happens, it happens. But I don't focus on it, and it's just a question of what can that person then... In catharsis, something is released. Mm-hmm. But then we have to see, well, what else will arise from it?
Right.
You know, can music be soothing? Yes, it can. By the way, speaking of childhood trauma, and this would be no news to you, but of all the people that I've talked to who were traumatized in childhood, music was their only escape.
Mm-hmm.
Was the realm of safety, was the realm of being held or being safe or being transported, at least, out of their traumatic mindset, you know. So there's a huge relationship there.
Right, and actually that raises another question that I wanted to mention, which is that not all music is pleasant or soothing. Sometimes it reflects very painful emotions. For example, I think, again, in the Western classical tradition of the funeral march movement of the Eroica, the Beethoven Eroica Symphony, and when it breaks into that fugal section, to me it feels like a scream of anguish. But, or, you know, the music of Shostakovich written during the Stalinist terror.
I was just yesterday listening to his Fifth Symphony.
Yes.
You know, yeah.
And, you know, and there can be irony and bitterness and many, many negative reactions. But there is a sense in which, at least for me, subjectively, that can be also an expression of recognition of emotions that I'm feeling, a sense of not being alone in that pain, and therefore a sense of kinship, which can be, again, comforting. That may not be healing. That may be more analgesic than, but this the feeling of isolation is something that tends to be diminished with that sense that there are others who understand what I'm going through.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned Beethoven, his funeral march. Mahler's got funeral marches in his symphonies, some of them. And I find them so compelling. Maybe because it mirrors me. And being mirrored is really important.
Well, the idea of, and I'm sure that this goes along with many aspects of trauma, is the feeling of isolation and aloneness, loneliness.
Yeah.
So in a sense, there is, I remember we did some work years ago with the late British film director, Anthony Minghella, who directed The English Patient.
Mm.
And he said, when I was young, I was a troubled kid. I was from an immigrant community, Italian in England. I felt alone. I felt isolated. I felt like nothing good would ever happen in my life. And there were two Canadians who got me through it because they expressed what I was feeling. And one of them was Leonard Cohen, and the other one was Glenn Gould.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a very powerful statement of acknowledgement that can come through the emotions expressed by music.
Yeah. Gould, of course, I have all of his recordings. And I'm no musicologist or musical expert, but compared to other people that play Bach, he's certainly idiosyncratic. And which is not a negative statement, it's just he's not usual. And I don't know if you knew him personally or not.
I did not. I've known many people who were very close to him, though.
But he was, let's face it, he was a neurodiverse character.
He was.
You know, and you wonder, I never studied his biography, but I would imagine there's some trauma there for him, that his neurodiversity expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And highly sensitive person, and he poured so much of himself into his music. And there's nothing more moving than there's a film of him re-recording the Goldberg Variations. There was the original mono recording. Mm-hmm. And he's sitting there hunched over the thing, and, you know, like he's just completely in his own world. And I think there was a lot of pain there, but so much sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. It's very intense, and you, when you say in his own world, that raises a very important other issue, which is something that he explicitly acknowledged. It's also an idea that goes back to the Greeks, which is ecstasy. The ability to, at least psychically or experientially, leave the world of self, of striving, of pain, of ego, and move into a state of consciousness that is in contact with a certain higher sense of reality.
Yeah.
And that for him was the essence. He sometimes spoke of music as being a source of what he called spiritual nourishment. This actually leads me, because I think that some aspects of that can be compared to the effects of meditation for those who are very serious about it.
Or psychedelics.
Well, I was about to mention that. Your own experience with psychedelics, ayahuasca, and so on. And do you think that there are parallels and comparisons that can be drawn? Obviously, we're still in a world where psychedelics are not universally available as a therapeutic methodology, and you have to go to some lengths to access them. Music, on the other hand, is completely ubiquitous. So, but in terms of the parts of the psyche and consciousness that they open up, do you see parallels? And also parallels in terms of the therapeutic applications?
Well, so first of all, I think this film, Eternal Song, one thing that, which is about the indigenous experience and the indigenous wisdom, what's clear is that for these people, there's no separation between the material and the spiritual, or the natural and the supernatural.
Right.
And that's how we evolved, number one. Number two, clearly there's brain circuits that you might call the God circuitry, portals where this mystical, unifying, deep experience can enter. Now, some people get there spontaneously. Hildegard of, what's her name?
Bingen, of Bingen.
Yeah, she's one of them.
Yes.
And of course, modern psychiatrists have wondered, did she have epilepsy? No, she didn't have epilepsy. She didn't have epilepsy. She had this portal open.
Right, she was a mystic.
She was a mystic. So some people can get that. I'm not wired for that, but some people are. The circuitry is there, but some people, the circuitry is more available.
Right.
No, you can also get, some people get there through meditation. Some people get there spontaneously. Some people get there through meditation. Some people have to sit in the Zen center for 20 years before they have it. Others have it as children completely spontaneously.
Yep.
I was like, why do they get to get it and I don't get to get it? You know. But in other words, there's a portal there. So the question is, is there only one way to get to the portal? Clearly not. And music is one of them. And certainly in my own relationship to music, a sense of spiritual fulfillment was one of the drives that I had. Now, music would only give it to me temporarily, but it would give it to me. You know, in terms of therapy, there is music therapy.
Yes.
It's actually sound therapy. And again, we're talking about the same portals, the same brain circuitry, in other words. So whatever you ask, the answer is yes.
Well, that's very, very good. And it's interesting because those portals also have resonances in, you know, certain elements of Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, and as rediscovered, this is bringing us back into a circle, in and reinterpreted in the 19th century by the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who used this concept that we're trapped in the self. you know.
Yeah.
But the universe is, you know, vast, powerful, dispassionate. We are mere, you know, particularities that get thrown up like droplets out of the sea, only to be swallowed back again. And the realization that there is this grandeur that is so far beyond us is something that strips away what he called the veil of Maya, to pick up a Buddhist term, that puts us in contact with a higher reality. And we can experience it by standing at the foot of a huge mountain that makes us feel, you know, that our ego is momentarily stripped away, or through the arts. And then he ranked the arts and ultimately came up with music as the highest. And this was a huge influence, again, on Wagner. So in a sense, I think what he was talking about was the ability to change one's consciousness, even if it can't be maintained on a permanent basis, and maybe it wouldn't be good for us if we were in a continuous state, because we'd probably forget to pay our taxes or, you know, go to work or, you know, do all the other things that are necessary for the more quotidian aspects of our existence. But he felt that it was a vital part of the human experience, and that rather than striving for money or success or rank or title, striving for that kind of enhanced consciousness was, you know, closer to the ultimate good for humans.
Well, what I understood you to summarize as Schopenhauer's teaching is precisely what indigenous wisdom has always taught. Mm-hmm. And I'm just reading a book, apropos, called Of Water and Spirit by Maladoma Patrice Somme, who's from Burkina Faso originally, mm-hmm. and comes from a tradition of shamans. And then, you know, and he talks about how in their tradition, religious materialization of some spirit that's here temporarily, and then, I don't know if I'd say we're trapped in it. I'm rather glad to be trapped in this body, in the sense that I'm glad to be alive.
Right.
And, but it is temporary, and it is like water a drop of water returning to the ocean. And for that drop to believe that it's an isolated, well, my psychiatrist friend and colleague Dan Siegel talks about the lie of the separate solo self.
Right.
And it exists, but it's not the be-all and the end-all, and it's not solo, and it's not separate. And no music, again, opens to that vast oceanic existence, especially not exclusively if you listen to indigenous chants and all that, but in the Western tradition, classical music finds it's the highest elaboration. And when you listen to a Beethoven or a Shostakovich, for that matter, Bartok, any one of them, they didn't do this on their own. They're channeling something.
Yes.
They have this incredible talent. But when you listen to Beethoven's late quartets, they're beyond time.
They are.
You could hardly place them in the early 19th century, can you? You know? Right. And like he was in some sphere that who knows how he got there and what allowed him to be there. But he was... I'm not saying he didn't create it. I mean, his talent had everything to do with it, but it couldn't have started from that little body.
Right.
No.
Exactly.
He's channeling something universal, you know?
Right. By the way, also an incredibly traumatized person. He had a horrible childhood.
Yeah.
But you're 100% right. The other thing about these composers in that tradition is that they did belong to a community, even though their work was largely conducted the composing in isolation, and that was a community of tradition because, you know, Mahler felt the presence of Beethoven and Schumann and Schubert, and before that, Mozart and Bach. And, you know, Bach belonged to a huge musical family and, you know, sought out, you know, other composers like Buxtehude and Lübeck in his own time. So there's always this sense of non-isolation, of being part of a larger whole, of, to, I guess, quote John Donne, not being an island, right? But being a part of a larger piece of mankind.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, when I look at an orchestra and I think of how does a human mind even create? I mean, I don't read music.
Right.
But I imagine if I could read a Mahler or a Shostakovich or Beethoven or Mozart symphony, do they write the parts for every instrument out?
They sure did.
Well, so how does the mind even do that? That when the oboe is doing this, the violin is doing that. And that's a miracle in itself, number one. And number two, then the secondary miracle, that a whole bunch of human beings get together, they sit down in the room, and then they recreate it.
Right.
And the oboe is doing what the oboe is meant to do, but it's not as an individual voice, but as part of a
unified collective.
It's incredible.
Yes. Well, to go back to, and to add to Beethoven without actually being able to hear. But that, you know, this may seem trite, but to go back to where I started in our musical conversation, it's incredibly complex, but look at the complexity of the number of areas of brain that are engaged in music. And if you essentially, you know, the neurons that fire together wire together, that old trope.
Which is, by the way, a Canadian trope.
A Canadian trope. Yay, yeah. Canada.
Donald Hebb was a Canadian neurophysiologist who said that.
Right. So those muscles get very built up. And one of the things that we find among the greatest composers is that they started from early childhood, very, very early. And we see it going back before Beethoven. It didn't start with Bach. Yeah. It didn't start, it's, you know, you look at the music of Palestrina and some of the Renaissance composers, and the polyphony is, I mean, look at John Taverner's Spem in Aulium. That is a piece in 41 distinct parts. 40 voice motet. Yeah, imagine being able to. It makes the complexity of Beethoven's parts seem, or even Bach's, simple by comparison. Mm. These are extraordinarily high levels of both intellectual but also emotional and spiritual consciousness, because they emerge not as just mathematical exercises. It's not like Sudoku. It is a sublime expression. And that perhaps brings me to a place on which to close, which is the question of the sublime. That's a more or less a 19th century and romantic concept, but beauty and the experience of beauty in our lives. I read a book. It wasn't a particularly good book, but and it's something I picked up off of a remainder shelf just out of curiosity, on a study of crime. Actually, I think it may have been murder. It was about murder. Mm. It wasn't a mystery book. It was a kind of a historical overview. And the writer, who seemed to have a fairly Victorian sensibility, even though it was written in, I think, the 1950s or 60s, suggested that the increasing prevalence or incidence of mass murder, serial killing, from the 19th century into the 20th century might potentially be correlated with the increasing urbanization, the packing together of people, the loss of experience of nature, and ultimately the creation of living spaces in which one did not experience beauty in a true sense for large parts of one's life, particularly in one's formative years. And of course, if you look at how people lived in Victorian London or in any of the major industrial cities, or even in New York in the latter half of the 19th century, it was grisly. Anyone who thinks that that was the glorious golden age of capitalism should take a look at the photo essay by, was it Jonathan Rhys? R-I-I-S.
Jacob, yeah. But he wrote a book called The Tenements of New York.
Exactly.
Or How the Other Half Lives.
How the Other Half Lives, yes. And it's a pioneer photo essay. So the photography is incredibly powerful. Okay, I think that to suggest that we increasingly have come to live in environments in which just the concept of beauty as something that needs to be part of life experience and a continuous part may be seen as kind of a poetic affectation, you know, something that is just, you know, some sort of artsy indulgence. But I'm wondering whether you have other thoughts on the aesthetic element of the human psyche, the ability to experience joy in the experience of beautiful things, beautiful ideas, beautiful music, and whether that is something that we don't pay enough attention to.
You know, I'm not talking as any kind of an expert here. I'm just giving my personal response. Beauty is one aspect of it, but can Shostakovich's symphonies be called beautiful? There are some elements of beauty for sure, and it's amazing how playful it could be sometimes, but it can also be very dour and bitter and
tragic.
Tragic, yeah. And he was expressing his own life in a certain context. So the essence for me is not beauty conventionally defined, but truth. So does music expect truth? That's what matters. Does it represent human experience? Yes. And beauty is a part of it. So is tragedy, you know? And I think it's all necessary. Now, Keats says, truth is beauty and beauty is truth, and that's all you need to know. Well, if we accept beauty as truth, but that truth can be bitter sometimes or can be challenging or discordant sometimes, then yes. But if we think of beauty only in the sense of pretty or immediately appealing, I think that's too narrow.
And superficial.
Yeah.
Agreed. And just to sort of follow on that, flattery, which is a form of lying to give pleasure, cannot be described as beautiful. Lying, even if it is to conjure up what one wants to hear, could never meet a definition that I would embrace of beauty. Honesty has much of beauty about it, even if it involves honesty about things that are painful.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Last thing I just wanted to add is, while I share your feelings about Western classical music, I do want to hasten to say that there are innumerable ways to skin the cat, and that, you know, for example, the folk and indigenous traditional musics of all the people of the world, Indian classical music, Bollywood music, dance music, you know, Japanese music played on the koto, Chinese music. These are all pathways. And, you know, essentially, if it gets you there, then it was worth the journey.
You know, one of my most moving experiences has been under ayahuasca and listening to these chants of these, whether from Colombia or Peru. And one of the most moving experiences I ever had was I was in an ayahuasca ceremony, and this woman who helped to do the chanting, she's actually a midwife. Mm-hmm. But she came down to me, said that she just noticed something about me as I was lying on the mat, and she sits down next to me and she sings this beautiful Lakota lullaby. And I just wept.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, I don't want to call it a simple tune, it's not simplistic, but it's a very beautiful, the lullaby lulls you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most moving musical experiences I've had in my whole life.
And you found those experiences to be part of your own healing process, the journey towards understanding yourself and freeing things that were in some ways trapped.
And actually, in these ayahuasca ceremonies, chanting and singing is a huge part of it. Or if you look at the Iboga experiences of people from Gabon, if you listen to that singing, they're chanting, and they're chanting in spontaneous harmony.
Mm-hmm.
It's not rehearsed.
No.
But the harmony arises from the experience.
Right.
Oh my, is that powerful.
Yes, and one of the things that, in at least in most of my experiences of chant, that is very powerful is repetition, the building of emotion through repetition, which makes me, of course, think about one of the winners of our Glenn Gould Prize, Philip Glass, who basically turned those elements, and partly as a result of his experience with Indian classical music and his work with Ravi Shankar early in his life, into a fundamental building block of his medium of expression.
I've listened to Glass, and I get that.
Yeah. Well, Gabor, you've been extremely generous to spend so much time with us. I would like to ask you, since our audience, we hope, includes parents, many of whom may be concerned that their children may not be getting music lessons in school or that those lessons may be discontinued, educators, including music teachers who may no longer be in that position, policymakers who may be able to influence the decision about the universal availability of music, people from the medical and helping professions, people with an experience in early childhood development, people who want to start community music education programs. We have a very, very wide-ranging audience, I hope. And if there are any parting thoughts that you might like to leave with them, specifically on the idea that we are trying to champion with this World Congress, which is that music is a right for every child, and the ability to learn it and express it and make it should be treated that way as a universally available good in their lives.
I can go back to two strands in our conversation. One is, first of all, the universality of music and human experience. The universality. It's not accidental. Now, the problem is, we used to live in a society where music was created in the home and in the communal meetings and in the communal experiences. That's no longer the case. Music is consumed much more than it is created these days. And we lose something in that process. So why not help our children create music and teach them how to do it and give them the space and the venue and the possibility of doing so? Number one. Number two, anybody who's listening, just ask yourself, how important has music been in your life? And what would your life be like if we stripped music out of your life right now? Or at any time in your life? So that's how important it is. And if it's that important, what sense does it make not to incorporate it and to make it a value in education, in healing, in social life, in family life?
It belongs to us all, and we need to share it, cherish it, and, if I can say so, universalize it, because as the philosopher Nietzsche said, without music, life would be a mistake.
And as somebody said, without Bach, God would be a very boring fellow.
Touché. Gabor, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.